I can see it all so clear. In my mind's eye, I have the feeling that I've got something to say. The tip of my tongue is burning. I've gotta hold on tight before it slips away. Frustration.
Don't get the best of me.
I know that it'll come to me soon. Just gotta keep.
Welcome to episode 2 of Comic Pop Library. I'm Richard Brookman with co-hosts Mickey Cowell and Royce Kitts. Today we'll be looking at Amazing Screw-On Head, Strange Science Fantasy, and Kingyo Used Books. We are actually going to start off with Strange Science Fantasy, and this is Mickey's choice for review. So, Mickey, take it away.
Thanks very much, Richard. Strange Science Fantasy is an over-the-top and wacky classic Silver Age monster anthology pastiche, so to speak, and it really harkens back to the early days in the late 50s and 60s of those crazy Marvel monster comics. It's got a big dose of modern commentary as well, and it is all produced by a very talented guy named Scott Morse. Some of you may know Scott Morse from a Catwoman series he did for DC, an Elektra, Echo and Glimpse series he did for Marvel Comics. He's been in the mainstream and he's worked in animation. He's been around a while. Very distinctive style. He works primarily with brushes and disposable brush markers. So he also uses digital coloring. He's one of those cats that when you see his work, you immediately know his fingerprints are all over it. This Strange Science Fantasy is a 6-issue mini from IDW. It is not yet out as a trade, but I'm going to be reviewing it anyway because that whole storyline is sure to be collected into a trade anytime.
And to interrupt just a moment, it is going to be out in April.
Yay, all right.
If librarians want to pre-order it, right now I'm looking at Amazon and they got a pre-order for $16.49 from $24.99, so that's not too bad.
Excellent book, and the thing I like about it is that it was really serially starting this last July in 2010. The last issue, number 6, came out in December. It really introduces and expands on this concept that came from Scott Morse's blog back in 2009. He created a short series of standalone stories in the style of these classic Marvel Comics monster stories of the late 50s and early 60s. And you guys probably have seen some of them anthologized. These are written by Stan Lee and drawn by legendary artists like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and Dick Ayers and Don Heck. And they basically were 3, 5, or 8-page monster stories. And the monsters always had some crazy name. And, you know, there would be different concepts, some sci-fi based, some sort of genre based. So there'd be like war stories, or there'd be like space stories or whatever.
And this is almost a series of almost each issue is what you're talking about, each genre almost.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what Scott Morse, in fact, says in a lot of his interviews around Strange Science Fantasy before it was released. He said, aesthetically at least, the old, you know, pre-hero monster titles from Atlas and Marvel, like Strange Tales, Tales to Astonish, Journey into Mystery, they all fed into this feeling that he wanted to capture for Strange Science Fantasy. Morse says that he began the series as kind of an off-the-cuff creative experiment. He wanted to have complete stories featuring characters that might or might not appear in the next issue, and he basically just kind of went with what was in his head. He only had a few rules that he said he adhered to in the series, and Richard, you probably noticed these. He said, number one, no penciling. In other words, there's nothing on the page before he takes that disposable brush pen and starts the panel. There's no penciling, there's no layout, there's no thumbnails. In other words, he's just writing as he goes, which is crazy.
You can kind of tell that because a lot of these panels, you know, you can tell that they're just there.
Yeah, exactly. He's just sort of letting the flow happen.
And it works. It's surprisingly. Because when I first opened, I was like, oh my goodness. And then when I got into it, I said, this actually works. So.
Well, Morse said that all the dialogue was just done in one massive swoop right at the end as he was hand lettering everything. And then he applied the digital color at the end. He wanted to figure out a quick, easy way to color the book and give it a certain look and feel. So once his art was finished and scanned, and he colored it all again in one go to try and give the colors some coherence and some emotional intensity, just like a film, basically. And it is very cinematic in a lot of ways. And as you know, the second issue, or rather the third issue of the story, even takes on an overtly cinematic quality with a strange character called the Projectionist that has a film camera for a head.
And I think that was my favorite one.
Yeah, really, I mean, a top-notch story.
What was it? Just some of the allegories, you know, the key grip. You know, he had keys on his fingertips.
Exactly.
Script Girl was a typewriter. It was just great.
A lot of funny puns and visual puns and metaphors. The first two issues of this series, A Strange Science Fantasy, reprint the original blog stories that were on Scott Morse's blog, Dawn of the Gearheads and Shogunaut. And the first two stories definitely set the stage and the tone for the things that follow. The final issue, which just came out in December, kind of wraps all of the other storylines up into this large cosmic tapestry that manages to be both funny and pretty deeply philosophical, I think. It's a really interesting kind of an approach to comic storytelling, and the reason I chose this storyline is because from the very first issue, you got a sense that this was something fresh, different, and new.
Well, I know when I first started, I had to reread the first issue, or at least the first half, to figure out what was happening. And what I liked about the consecutive issues, it gave a little blurb at the beginning, and that kind of helped set the tone. So if first-time readers just picking it up, the first one might be a little tough, but after that, you have those short blurbs. And that,
I should should say something about the format of the floppies themselves. They're all done on very high-quality paper. He uses this disposable marker brush, and so each page is laid out in kind of a widescreen format so that he either uses the full page or he uses a three-panel tiered approach in every page. So you've got these big, wide panels that look like a widescreen cinema-style kind of a thing. And his drawing just accelerates everything at this real breakneck speed. He has hand-lettered captions under the panels that just sort of speed everything along because everything's in great, big, large hand-lettered print. And all the action happens in these staccato bursts. You've got every image having a different point of view, a different camera angle, close-up, panorama. And so the whole effect is one of this sort of, you start the story and you're just like powering through to the very end.
And it had the old 50s feel to it. And
absolutely.
Just to go back to the third issue again, the way it ended with the theaters taking on television. I mean, that had the big old head of the TV and him coming after him. That was hilarious.
The first story is called Dawn of the Gearheads, and he calls it High Octane Adventure, and it is kind of his tip of the hat to those car science fiction stories, you know, like Death Race 2000 and all those crazy movies from our childhoods, and also some of the comic books. Like, there were a lot of real popular drag racing comics in the early 60s that people my age read a lot. So it's kind of a combination of a space story and a gearhead story, and it really is High Octane Adventure, as he calls it. The second issue is Shogunaut, and it is kind of a what he calls far-fetched feudal fireworks. It's kind of a samurai story. So you've got this astronaut, shogun, samurai-type character, and another character named Knucklehead, who sort of have this cosmic interaction with cosmic entity. And it's, again, it's just off-the-wall crazy stuff. And you really never know that any of these things connect. They seem like standalone stories as you're reading them. The third story is the one Richard made reference to. It's called The Projectionist versus the Silent Scream, and it is a very cinematic kind of, almost like a film noir homage to a tip of the hat to the old Sam Spade detective story kind of things, where you have to sort of solve a mystery in the process of these kind of over-the-top crazy characters like this guy with a film, you know, head, with a camera head. The fourth story is called Meet Gigantic. That's gigantic. You know, it's a wonder nobody made that pun before. And it is a combination of a sort of a war comic story and a science fiction story, which is still popular today. I don't know if you guys have read Fear Agent, Rick Remender's Fear Agent.
I've read a few of those, but this one gave me the Attack of the 50-Foot Woman vibe.
Oh, right on. Exactly right. You know, you've got the military and their little tanks, and they're shooting at this gigantic creature somewhere. This is a space story, basically, where a GI is taken and given special treatment so that he becomes this gigantic and fights space aliens that are threatening, as far as we know, threatening our world. The fifth story is an homage to Plastic Man and Jack Cole's creation from from late 40s, 50s. And that is, it's kind of a sad, almost, I don't know if the original Daredevil story resonated with you guys, you know, the blonde, the son of a bookish son of a boxer, prize fighter, who has to reach sort of a heroic place to succeed in life. It's that kind of a story, kind of a melodrama, but it basically has a real love story at the core of it, where a character, a gangster, gets transformed into a kind of a bendy, stretchy character who has to sort of evade gangsters and cops and keep his girlfriend and her mom happy and the whole thing. It's kind of a crazy, wacky romance a la Jack Cole.
And for all he tries, he can't do anything right. I just...
Yeah, I can relate to that.
It is.
Yeah, just nothing happens good for this poor guy. The final story is really very ambitious. I think Morse tried to pull everything together in this last story. You know, he wanted to take this whole concept of these off the wall, over the top, crazy characters and bring them together. And in what I like to think of is kind of a pop culture as religion idea. You know, that there's this sort of a giant overarching cosmic reason for all of this craziness to have occurred in the past six issues. Or past five issues, and Temple of Manga Ka is the name of the sixth issue, and he basically tries to create this gigantic mythology about, you know, why these stories have been told and what the context is of these stories and what this, you know, the cosmic purpose of all of this is in a manga context with cartooning and art and all this other stuff thrown in.
And I have a feeling he just got finished watching the last indie film. I don't know. That just feels that way.
Yeah, it's got that Indiana Jones adventure, crazy stuff. And yeah, definitely the last issue starts off with a dead pastiche of the opening of the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And it's kind of like you said, and I kind of mentioned this to my kids, you know, if we were destroyed and they would come excavate our artifacts, if you want to call them that, and they unearth, you know, I have a diecast of the Enterprise. You know, if these were new people, they would think, oh, were they flying around in that thing then?
Exactly.
So that kind of, it had that vibe, so that was kind of cool. And Logan read these, my son, and he liked them. He's one of those that likes every little bit of everything wild. He enjoyed these, so. And he's 15, so it'll appeal to teenagers, but to me, it feels like it's more geared, like Royce had been saying, than you. It's for the adult male.
I think so, too, and I think it has enough depth to it that it would appeal to an adult reader. That's about it, but I just want to make a final comment, and that is that if you are a Scott Morse fan and you're familiar with his work from the past, you know that design plays a huge role in his storytelling, both in terms of the look and feel of the book and how the material is presented. You've got bold shapes, vivid colors, dreamlike landscapes, a lot of bold brushstrokes, unorthodox layouts, a lot of scene cutting, and this balloonless hand lettering of narration and dialogue. So a lot of his animation experience, and he's worked with like Pixar and DreamWorks, a lot of that is brought into the comics. So it really is a very, very cinematic experience. I can't wait for the trade to come out. A final note is that Paul Pope, who is another indie creator that I like a lot, contributed single-page backups to each one of these issues. And what Paul Pope has done, is to try to encapsulate the entire previous story in one page and sort of give you a taste or a flavor or a synopsis of what the story was about in one page. It's really very ambitious, and I think he does a great job of it.
And as Royce, hopefully you'll pick it up. But it's fun, and this is one of the things.
Yeah, sounds like a really good book.
You ready to take the next shot at it, Royce?
Sure, why
not?
Okay,
we have Amazing Screw-On Head.
Yeah, for those of you not familiar with the name Mike Mignola, you know, I apologize if I say the name wrong. I'm used to just reading it. I don't say these things out loud. But you might be familiar with him from Hellboy, BPRD, Abe Sapien, those comics. And then this is something that we ordered here at the library, and it's two different stories that have been produced about 8 years ago, 7-8 years ago. One is The Amazing Screw-On Head, and the other one is The Magician and the Snake. And he's also combined some other stories into it. So what you have here is, for those of you not familiar with him, is you have a nice collection of his artwork, and you get a good sense of how he goes about creating stories. And, you know, my favorite thing about this is definitely the artwork. There's no one else out there, I think, does anything even close to the quality of the artwork that Mike Mignola does. And one of the things I really like about it, it does kind of have this steampunky kind of vibe where, you know, you'll have these gentlemen in their double-breasted suits with their pocket watches. And then you'll also have like some kind of machine, you know, that's flying through the air that, you know, just looks very out of place and out of time. And there's always, you know, weird witches and beasts and demons. And part of the beauty of these stories too is none of this stuff ever catches anybody by surprise. It's always like, oh yeah, there's a guy with a screw on head. You know, it's just kind of taken for granted that this is the world that we live in is one that is like this. My favorite story in this collection is called The Magician and the Snake. And I think one of the things that people appreciate about this was it's a very short story. It's actually from an anthology, a Dark Horse anthology. And it's only about, let's see here, I'm holding
a couple of pages, seven?
It looks like it's five pages.
Five, okay.
And it's just a story that his daughter made up. And it's just a wonderful story about a magician who's getting older.
I love how it has flies hanging around. Have you noticed that in a lot of his pictures?
Well, you know, I think that's the beauty of this, of someone like him. When you start to really look at it, you know, you look at it and you think, well, this looks rather crude and simplistic. And I think, you know, when you just glance at it, you're like, well, it doesn't look like he did a lot here. And that's when you realize that
takes more effort than what it looks like.
He's doing things with color and composition that are different than most comics.
Well, remember, Mike Mignola's been doing comics since for 30 years. He started with Marvel in the 80s. His style has morphed over the years. But I have to tell you that the colors that you alluded to, a lot of that is Dave Stewart's work at Dark Horse. Dave Stewart is this phenomenal colorist that's been doing all of his work, all of Mignola's work for years, and the two of them work hand in glove together. And as you know, Mignola uses these heavy, heavy, heavy blacks all the time. His style has really morphed into a sort of a granitic black, you know, huge monolithic chunks of black on a page and a few lines to express a face or you know, a feature or a figure. I think he's become more and more abstract over the years, but I agree with you. I love his art, but I think there are other people that do similar quality. You know, Mignola is kind of an acquired taste, but once you've acquired it, you can't get enough of it. That's the way I feel about him. That's the way I feel about Scott Morse. That's the way I feel about Kyle Baker. That's the way I feel about Eric Powell. I mean, once you understand their sort of their stylistic fingerprints, you just can't get enough of them.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Eric Powell because, you know, like I said earlier in the previous podcast, one of the things that I really enjoy is The Goon and Hellboy and the approach to the artwork by Powell and by Mignola is just something that really fascinates me. And it's something that, you know, the more I focus in on those two, the less I'm satisfied with conventional superhero artwork. Because in there, they don't leave anything to imagination. It's all drawn out there for you. But this stuff, you know, it's the black spaces and the dark spaces that define the situation as much as all the different action lines.
Well, you have what I like is you have all those dark spaces, but yet there's a light sensitivity to it as well. It's, you know, it's not dark, dark in tone. It has a humor to it as well.
Yeah, and you know, one of the beautiful things that I really like about a lot of these stories too is he's not one who reaches for that climactic finish. You know, it's like most of the action takes place kind of in the middle, and then there's kind of this gradually getting away from the story and getting back into normal life. And that's what I appreciate so much about the characters he creates in this collection of The Amazing Screw-on-Head is just this whole, you really get a sense for the universe that he creates by these little snippets. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I really like is when I pick up, especially a hardcover book, you know, where they've, you know, I think some people might think, well, they just throw these sketchbook things in at the back. And it's actually one of my favorite parts of this book is he does these little portraits that are throughout the book, and they're just wonderful. One of my favorites is he does a series of portraits of these Victorian ladies, and they have little signs on them. One says werewolf, one says cannibal, and then I love the last one says criminal lunatic.
Y'all right there?
Yeah, I hope I got that muted in time. I'm sorry, I just really get a tickle in my throat.
That's fine.
But I think the sketchbook at the back is just really incredible as he walks you through his creative process. And I tell you, this guy, you know, he just draws like a little puff of smoke, and there's just something that speaks to you. I mean, every single line that he draws, you know, maybe this is what obsession is about, but every single line seems to have a purpose, and everything means something. It's just beautiful. It's incredible. I just can't ever get enough of it. And for someone who's not familiar and may not like Hellboy at all, this might be something for them to check out and try out.
It's really off the wall. There's no superhero heroics. It's really kind of an absurd story about a screw-on head troubleshooter adventurer working for President Lincoln. You forgot to mention it's a period set during the Civil War, and so you've got this strange period piece with a character who is obviously absurd beyond belief, but everyone sort of acts like it's normal that he can screw off his head and has a butler that does weird stuff and all this crazy stuff. It's truly an absurd storyline, and yet somehow it sort of moves from point A to B to C in a very logical and sort of convincing way. So by the end of the story, you kind of like are really sucked into this concept of a screw-on head adventurer.
Yeah, and that's what reminded me of Goon a lot too, was in that sense of you just really have these characters that just make absolutely no sense, you know, the Wicker Man, you know, the zombie, you know, just all these characters that just seem out of place, but you know, it's not out of the normal in these stories. It's wonderful.
I think in Abu Gong, I don't know if he did this intentionally, but if he really wanted to, he could actually tie this back into Hellboy, because the devil entity in this really resembles Hellboy quite a bit, if you look through that story.
Oh, yeah. You know, and you know, one of the things, now we're going to start talking about Hellboy. the baby Hellboy is something that I think is very cute and very appealing. And Mickey might know about this, but I wonder if he's done any kind of stories geared more towards a younger audience with kind of that baby Hellboy character, because it just seems like something that's very marketable. Maybe that's not
Well, I think you're referring to Hellboy Jr., and that's really Bill Morrison's sort of take. Okay. He borrowed Hellboy and basically asked Mignola if he could sort of create this nutty sort of devilish hot stuff character, you know, based on that old Harvey cartoon character with a bunch of craziness around it. So that's really not a Mignola character, other than he got, you know, Mignola's blessing to do this. But Bill Morrison, Bill Ray actually took this stuff and made it his own. So, yeah, I don't know that Mignola is particularly comfortable let me take that back. Mignola seems to be very comfortable lending his creations out to other creators and saying, go to town and do this and do that with it. I'm not familiar with any specifically targeted children's materials that he's created, but you're right, he would be really cool if he did that.
Well, there's just he can get very dark, but then there's times where it becomes very innocent and childlike and just very on a very human level, very touching, that I think is just remarkable for his creative powers. It's just great stuff. As I said, he's one of my favorites, so I can't find anything wrong with it.
So looking for Screw On Head, and if you like that, continue on to Hellboy.
Yeah, and you know, and in case you're wondering if Hellboy and the Goon ever meet up, there actually is a comic where they meet up, and it's quite funny.
I'd like to thank one of our sponsors at this time, Music Alley from Mivio. Andrew Lehman's song Train of Thought was provided from Mivio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.mivio.com. That is MUSIC.MEVIO.com. Or you can go to our site, Comic Pop Library, for links to Music Alley and or Train of Thought by Andrew Lehman in our reference links located within our left navigation bar. And now, back to the show.
I tortured Royce this time around with my choice of reviews. It's Kinyo Used Books, and you might have to help me on some of these pronunciations. Mickey, I didn't know you grew up in Japan, but the story and art's by Simul Yoshizaki. I could be wrong. she has done several other titles in Japan, but I think this is her first adaptation into English. Pretty sure that's how it is. I might be wrong. Don't quote me on that. To me, and I'm going to be using terminology and I'll explain what I'm using them, but it feels like a Josei or a shonen title, and a Josei is more of a women's title, and a shonen is more of a men's title geared for an adult male or adult man, or excuse me, female. And to me, that's what it felt like. This was geared for the adult market. And we were kind of talking before the cast that some of the people that are coming back into the medium, this book is basically that in a nutshell. It's about these characters, and it's about 8 short stories, I believe, of these individuals coming to this used bookstore and recapturing their youth and finding that even their friends still remember these characters that they loved and enjoyed as teenagers, and a lot of them start back to reading, and some of them are, each little story has a little bit of a moralistic tale to it as well, and that kind of makes it a little bit more interesting. for the average manga reader, which is probably like the American readers, you're going to have your teenage boys. This will probably be a little slow for them, unless they're really interested in the medium. Then they might enjoy it. One of the cool features I liked about it was in the back of the book, and this is one of those which it's flipped. You have to read it from right to left. But in the back of the book, it has all the references that it used within the story, and they actually use actual manga titles that are in publication or were in publication in Japan. Some of them have been translated for the English audience, some of them not, but it just gives you a little quick snapshot of that title. And for somebody that's interested in the Japanese culture and the manga, it's really nice, and it's what, maybe a page in length. I don't have it in front of me. I think Roy still has it, if I remember right.
I do.
Richard, let me ask you about this series. To me, this is such a curious title that a guy in Southwest Kansas would like, because it's so quiet and bookish, and it's so, you know, it's so about rediscovering pleasures of reading when you're a youth and stuff like that. And honestly, I mean, would you agree? Absolutely nothing happens in the story. It's not about action or about big climactic moments. It's about these little episodes. You know, it's almost like a little story within a story for each one of these characters that rediscovers something they loved when they were children. So what is it that appealed to you? Was it the story or the art, or was it just the quiet tone of it?
To me, it was the aspect, like we talked about earlier, of somebody coming back into the comic books. That just reminded me of myself coming back into it as a young adult of about 22-ish, saying, oh, I remember these. This is very neat. And I do like the action ramped up, I'll admit, but it's a nice change of pace. And sometimes you like that when you're use a food reference when you're eating. You like a change of taste just to have something different so often. The only drawback I had of this, and maybe this will continue on in the series, is some of these stories kind of, and I might be intentional, they were left hanging so that you can interpret the rest of the story yourself. Or I don't know if she's going to come back and expand on the stories of these characters later on in the series. There's a possibility of that. So, and I know there's a group of people that do not like that. You know, if you read a book and it just kind of ends, they don't want to try to continue the story. They want the ending and that's it. You know, they don't want to use their imagination where, you know, if I'm in the right mood, that it's perfectly fine for me, because sometimes what I make up in my head is a lot more funner than what's actually put down on page or up on celluloid or digital, I guess, now. So, change of pace, Mickey. How's that sound?
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I'm used to a more adventure style manga, I guess. And so when I read this quiet little story, I was like, wow, this is sort of mature and in some ways sophisticated. And but the whole premise of the story, which is this whole rediscovering the pleasures of reading as a youth and kind of wrapped up in this story, almost like a history of manga to some extent. Right. I thought that was kind of like really kind of sophisticated. And I wondered if a first time reader would really respond well to this. You have to sort of be steeped in manga to some extent to appreciate
it. True. True, and that's definitely what I feel. You can't just jump into this and have this be the first one. I think, Royce, you kind of mentioned it might be. How do you see that? I mean,
well, you know, I said, you know, one of those things for me is definitely for manga is the difficulty my brain has in forwarding the story. I mean, it just really is hard for me. But, you know, the thing I liked about this one is it gave me a couple of color pages to start off. So, I mean, that was something I was a little bit used to. I really liked it.
Wow.
And
shocking.
Well, you know, the thing for me is, you know, I'm not really familiar with manga very much, but it was the last story, and one of the really popular mangas here is called One Piece. And so there's a couple of images in here where it kind of reminded me of that. And so for me, that was kind of like, wow, I know a little bit about this stuff. And to have the stuff in the back where it tells you about other titles that have come out, I just thought that was really brilliant. I don't know if these titles they mention are exactly, you know, the cream of the crop, but, you know, just to have somebody say at the end, hey, this is some other stuff you might like. It's kind of like that YouTube thing where you find a cool video and at the end they tell you other videos you might like. And
right.
That's something I really like. It's something when I'm reading a comic by someone that I like.
And that's her catch,
you know, I'll look in the back and I'll I'll see other titles they mention. It was common with like vinyl LPs that you'd pull out your record and there'd be the advertisement of all the latest records that came out. So it kind of had that nostalgic feel for me, the stuff in the back. And so I thought this was really nice. You know, the negative stuff I hear about manga a lot is, you know, this hyper-sexualized content. And then what I think about this is this might be a good beginner one for someone who thinks that is kind of what manga is all about, is, you know, big punches and things exploding and that kind of content.
Right.
It's very refreshing, and I think it's very nice.
Well, I know the second volume is out. The third one is getting ready to be released or is out already. It's one that you could almost give to a female audience member, especially, like Mickey says, it helps if you're a little bit related to the titles involved. And that is her big hook, is in every story she mentions an actual manga, and then, you know, it's referenced in the back of the book.
It's really intensely a sentimental story. And, you know, that's like most sentimental stories. Some people like them, some people get turned off by them. But, boy, it's so sentimental and even mawkish sometimes with so much emotion that, you know, I can see that it would be appealing to a lot of girls and boy readers as well, and certainly to adults who are more tolerant, I think, of that kind of hard-on-sleeve emotion.
And I can't say I'll give it a full-hearted go out and get this, because, you know, this is definitely for a choice audience. I mean, it's recommended, but you might have to push the title a little bit when you have it in your library to steer people towards it.
Well done, Richard. I agree. It's a different thing. I'm glad you chose to review this, because it's really not your run-of-the-mill manga title at all.
I saw an interesting rating system that somebody had used online the other day on what they thought about a book that they wanted to read, and one of them was go to the bookstore and buy it. The next level was order it online, and then their third level was check it out at the library. So maybe this is one of those that, you know, if you're not recommending people go out and buy it, you know, it looks
it's
like
a library.
There is a library in Kansas that has it.
True. And we enter a library loan all over the place. I think the furthest we've sent one is over to England. We sent an X-Men trade over there. Well, that was kind of fun. So I think, Royce, you can't really comment about Strange Science Fantasy, but I'd give it a, if you want to steal from another company, a thumbs up. I enjoyed it. I like the feel of it. I think Mickey loved it.
I think he takes
it to bed with him every night. I do.
I think it's a fabulous read. I can't wait for the trade to come out. And I'm glad you told me it's coming out in April, because, as you know, they often put extras in with trades. I'm hoping there'll be a few extras and maybe some comments from Scott Morse about how he developed this. It's really a strange piece of fantasy, and it's aptly titled, but I would recommend it for your collections for adults, teens, and folks that like good stories.
And I think Royce definitely did a tried and true. Definitely, if you don't have it, at least let your readers know about the Mike Mignola collections.
Oh, and that, just to mention that those Dark Horse hardcovers are real bargains. They're usually bargain price. They cost, you know, somewhere between $14.95 to $17.95. They're well bound, beautifully printed in color, and those Dark Horse hardcovers are real bargains for libraries.
And I was kind of surprised Royce even picked this. I was expecting a crime noir story.
Area 10. Maybe it'll be his next pick.
There you go.
Yeah, you know, that's that. This is one of those things where, you know, one of the things I like to do is go to a local comic shop there in Lawrence and pick off titles that are just sitting there on a shelf. And I picked this one up. I don't know. I don't know why I picked it up. It just, something spoke to me about it all of a sudden, so I had to get it. So I would recommend it, definitely. And it is in a library in Kansas if you need it.
Oh, yes. And Kenyo Used Books, I recommend it, but you're going to have to do a little bit of legwork for it. It's a great story, but definitely not your mainstream audience type story. If you can steer people to it, I think it will be checked out. And this is pretty much the style we're going to go with the cast. We're going to just be reviewing what we're currently reading, whether it's old, new, stealing issues like Mickey did to us. I think I spent $30 for you, Mickey. You owe me some drinks. There you go. For Mickey Royce, this is Richard.
Know. Still shows him hanging out on here.
He might have got.
But yeah, I can't wait to read it. It sounds like a good title, but, you know, that's the beauty. The beauty of the business is I'll wait till it's collected.
True. That's what we'll do, and we'll pick it up for our library. But for Mickey and Royce, this is Richard saying thank you for listening, and join us again for our next episode.
I could see it all so clear. Please believe me, I really had something to say. But now it's bye-bye to my thinking. Now that my thinking's gone, I got nothing to say. Determination, I know that. Just
Thank you for listening to Comic Pop Library. We welcome your comments and suggestions by emailing us at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. All emails submitted become the property of Comic Pop Library and are subject for use on our show. We would also appreciate it if you would spread the word about Comic Pop Library by posting about us on Twitter, Facebook, or just tell someone about us. This podcast is not endorsed by any comic book publisher or distributor and is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official site links of review publishers can be found on our website, www.comicpoplibrary.com. The views and comments of the Comic Pop Library host are not necessarily endorsed by the Finney County Public Library, Kearney County Library, Northeast Kansas Library System, and our Tokonganoxie Public Library.